speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, March 16th, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
The backlash against voter ID laws from the DOJ, civil rights, and labor organizations. Plus, working conditions in Chinese factories remain grim even as the iPad 3 is released today. And activists oppose Walmart's plans for a new store in Chinatown.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Long lines are forming outside of sleek Apple computer stores around the nation today as gadget trendsetters wait to be the first to own an iPad 3. The popular tablet is smaller than a piece of paper, thinner than a copy of Vogue magazine, and bestows the user with a degree of class status. Apple products were once unambiguous symbols of a fresh, forward-thinking ethos. But the highly publicized abuse and terrible working conditions of the Chinese laborers who assemble its goods has recently warped its image. Workers assembling Apple products at the Foxconn factory in China, which employs 1.2 million employees who also live on company property, report being packed into dorm rooms with as many as 20 people, working 24-hour shifts, and sustaining injuries from chemicals and machinery. Attention was first drawn to the factory after a rash of worker suicides. In the wake of consumer complaints last month, Apple announced the Foxconn factory would be monitored by the Fair Labor Association. Today, outside Apple stores around the country, Change.org is holding demonstrations to keep pressure on Apple to improve working conditions overseas. Change.org says labor monitoring is a step in the right direction, but it's calling on Apple to release a plan for how it will protect workers during the production blitz for the iPad 3 launch. Apple has not announced plans to raise the wages of its Chinese factory workers, which are about $2 an hour at the Foxconn factory. Meanwhile, Apple's profit margin is an astonishing 51%. My guest is Sarah Ryan, a senior campaigner with Change.org, joining us now from Washington, D.C., where an Apple store protest just took place this morning. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's go into some of these conditions that I briefly mentioned that Chinese workers experience at the Foxconn factory with up to 20 people in a dorm room and working shifts that can be as long as 24 hours. How severe are these conditions, particularly compared to other factories in China? I mean, is this not sort of par for the course when we talk now about products being made in China under conditions that aren't monitored by labor organizations?
Sure. Well, like you said, unfortunately, this is not an anomaly in China. This is not something that is unique to Foxconn factories. Working conditions in China are notoriously really terrible. But the reason that, you know, Mark Shields, the creator of this Change.org petition, and so many folks over here are calling on Apple and pinpointing Foxconn in particular, is because consumers have such a large voice now in dictating how they want their products to be manufactured and how they want the people who make their products to be treated. So, you know, they're starting off with just one particular factory, which, you know, employs tens of thousands of people. And then hopefully once they are able to improve conditions there, they can move on to other factories.
Now, Apple's profit margin for this latest iPad is a little bit lower than the one before that. But that's because it is employing a new technology in the screen it's using, which is more expensive. It has nothing to do, as far as I understand, with workers being paid more. In terms of how companies keep their profit margins, companies like Apple keep their profit margins high, they can reduce the prices of or reduce the costs of their raw materials as much as possible. But at some point, they just don't go lower. But then we're talking about labor and how much they pay their employees, which it seems like they can keep lowering them and lowering them and lowering them. Is that, you know, is that where companies like Apple tend to find their biggest savings?
No, like you said, Apple's profit margin is absolutely enormous. It's leaps and bounds ahead of any other technological or any other corporation in the world right now. So they have the money to pay their workers more. That's not a question. But another really interesting, fascinating result that's come out of this campaign is that people all across the United States and world even have said that they're willing to pay more for their iPhone, for their iPad, for their Mac, if that means that workers in China will be given fair living wages. So I think the number is that if Apple continues along the same profit margin that they're looking at, right, people could pay $65 more for their iPad in order to ensure that the factory workers making their iPad are given decent living wages and decent working conditions. And, you know, looking at the comments on the petition on change.org, people really bought into that, and they are willing to front the extra money in order for them to know, so they could be proud of their Apple product and know that it was made ethically.
Right. I mean, it's sad that it's not even a consideration to talk about Apple cutting into its profit margin. The only conversations we have are about consumers putting out more money. But, you know, these are digital gadgets. These are not what we might, at least for now, consider essential to our day-to-day lives. Maybe that will certainly change in the future. Certainly computers in general have become essential. But people shell out $500 for these new devices, and there are long lines at stores by people who are excited to be the first to own these products. What did the Washington, D.C. Apple store look like today? Tell us about the protest that happened.
Sure. So when we got there, and again, this was organized by Mark Shields. He created the petition on change.org that got like 250,000 signatures. So Mark organized protests in New York, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco. And so I was in the Washington, D.C. one where Mark was, and before the rally started, there were, I would say, about 50 people lined up outside of the Georgetown Apple store before it opened at 8 a.m. And, you know, when the protesters got there, so a bunch of people who had signed the campaign came, and Mark came, and they had a huge banner that was really incredible. It was the outline of the Apple, their logo, and inside had all of the comments of the petition signers. So there are folks holding that sign, folks going around with the petition on iPads, asking folks online to sign, in line to sign the petition, which was, you know, really, they responded very well to. A lot of people signed it. A lot of people.
So you were taking around iPads.
Yeah.
That had the electronic petitions for people to sign.
Yep. Which was a great press visual. So people, you know, they read the petition, and saw what kind of they were buying into with the iPad. But also realize that it's not bad to buy Apple products, but it's by being an Apple user, you now have the right to call on Apple to be better, because they have a voice. And as a consumer, you have a right to demand that your products are made ethically. So this protest just really showed consumers, showed people who are watching on TV, that consumers in this day have voices and they have power. It's just up to them to start using it more.
And it's amazing to think about what Apple is looking at with the launch of this new iPad in terms of how much money it is going to make. I mean, they expect to sell 2 to 3 million of these new iPads by the end this quarter, we're talking about within the month. And what sort of conditions are there at the factories when Apple has to meet these deadlines and this huge demand? Because when it does roll out a new product or a new model of an older product, it does so to much fanfare, a lot of media coverage, and the projections for how many products they're going to sell is likely putting severe pressure on the factory.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So when these new products come out, it's easy to think that, you know, the iPads come from a factory where they're just magically made and then shipped over to us in the shiny white boxes. But during these high production times, it's incredibly stressful in the factories for the factory workers. They have impossible quotas to meet just so we over here can make sure that we get our iPad within the first week, or first weekend even. So the factory workers are working double, triple shifts just in order to meet quotas. They're not being paid overtime. They're exposed to horrible toxic chemicals, which could lead to long-term and short-term disease and disfigurement. They're doing these horrible repetitive motions with their hands, whether it's just wiping the screen, whether it's putting one tiny little button on the iPad, which soon leads to they can't use their hands anymore because they've been doing this repetitive motion over and over. So the big ask of this rally today that's happening right now, actually in San Francisco, is that Apple create a worker protection plan that would, in fact, protect workers from these awful conditions during times of high productivity, so during times when Apple is releasing a new product. So I guess the next product launch would be the iPhone 5, probably.
So the Fair Labor Association, which is supposed to be monitoring the conditions at this particular factory, Foxconn, that has had some media coverage now of its workers' working conditions, has anyone been able to verify that that's indeed happening, that there's some labor monitoring happening?
Sure. So that was the first ask of the petition, which got granted right after the first petition delivery in February.
And this was a petition by Mark Shields that got over a quarter million.
So the same petition.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So this first ask that the FLA audit the Foxconn factories and then produce the results online. So it's basically to be as transparent as possible. And the Monday after the petition delivery in February, Apple said that they were going to do it. So the FLA is auditing these factories, and they should be announcing their results, publishing them on their website this month.
Okay. So then at this point, it's simply up to consumers and activists like yourself to monitor whether that is going to go through. These protests that are now happening in San Francisco and happened earlier in the day in Washington, D.C., are those meant to keep that pressure up then?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There are a lot of eyes on Apple right now from consumers, from labor organizations, from other companies who are kind of waiting to see what Apple does to see if they have to follow in Apple's footsteps. So whatever happens, you know,
right,
people are going to know about it, whether they do the audits, whether they don't, whether they respond to some of the poor working conditions.
Right.
So there's no way Apple's going to get away with not responding to anything.
The New York Times investigative piece that came out earlier this year called In China, Human Costs Are Built Into an iPad really detailed the working conditions there. I want to quote from it because we were talking earlier about what the new product launches, the kind of pressure that they put on factory workers. In January 2010, said this article in the New York Times, workers at a Chinese factory owned by WinTech, an Apple manufacturing partner, went on strike over a variety of issues, including widespread rumors that workers were being exposed to toxins. Investigations by news organizations revealed that over 100 employees had been injured by N-hexane, a toxic chemical that can cause nerve damage and paralysis. Employees said they had been ordered to use N-hexane to clean iPhone screens because it evaporated almost three times as fast as rubbing alcohol. Faster evaporation meant workers could clean more screens each minute. And apparently Apple did respond and has stopped using N-hexane. I want to ask you what effect this article, the New York Times article, had on this movement now to make iPads slightly more ethical gadgets to own.
Yeah, absolutely. So this article had a huge, huge impact. This was actually what propelled Mark Shields to start his campaign. He read this article, you know, saw himself as an Apple super user, so he owns all Apple products and he loves them. But really, after reading this article, couldn't claim ignorance anymore about where his products come from. They just don't come from the Apple store. They come from China. They come from, you know, people's human costs, like it, the article said. So, you know, he was thinking, trying to figure out what to do, what he could do as now an informed consumer, and then decided to start a change.org petition.
And do you feel that Apple has been responsive enough so far? And do you feel optimistic that this company is going to continue? Because past campaigns over, you know, past decades against companies like Nike have often shown that companies try to sidestep the pressure and try to give the impression that they're responding. And it's only through years and years of very intense activism and very confrontational exposés that that these companies do respond to pressure.
You know, I think you asked, is Apple responding enough? I think Apple is responding, not enough yet. And this is part of the reason why Mark organized the second rally, because, you know, they made a huge step, right? They allowed the FLA to come in and audit their factories, which is great. But workers still don't have a protection program. They're still not paid a living, decent wage. So, you know, the fight isn't over. The fight's not going to be over for a long time. But hopefully, you know, Apple has a great great image because they are very progressive. Their motto is to think different. So we're, you know, now pushing them more to start thinking different, thinking ethically, think ethical iPhone, think workers' rights, think respect of workers. And I think Apple is absolutely on their way, and they have the motivation, they have the opportunity to be that leading innovator in the tech industry or in the consumer industry to start respecting workers' rights, not only in the United States, but also abroad.
Well, Sarah Ryan, I'm assuming change.org is where listeners can go to online to find out more about how they can get involved?
Yeah, it's change.org/Foxconn, F-O-X-C-O-N-N.
That's change.org/Foxconn. Sarah Ryan is a senior campaigner with change.org. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
Sarah Ryan, again, senior campaigner. She is with change.org. She joined us from Washington, D.C., where there was an Apple store protest to coincide with the rollout of the iPad 3. A protest is currently happening at the San Francisco Apple store. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we'll take a look at the growing rash of voter ID laws across the nation and the growing backlash, both from the Department of Justice and organizations like civil rights groups and labor groups. Then we hear this week's Rethink Reviews on 21 Jump Street. Finally, Walmart is pushing for its first new store in LA in a decade. In Chinatown, activists are pushing back. Stay tuned. If I could just hold on until the morning dawns, and nothing remains but a better day in my soul. Sing up and way downtown now behind me, and I will be moving, and I will be grooving, yes, I will. Nobody told me, nobody told me, nobody told me. Nobody Told Me by Vintage Trouble, based here in Los Angeles. More about them online at vintagetrouble.com. Or check the featured music section of uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Pennsylvania became the latest state in the nation this week to enact a strict voter identification law, a bill voted on by the majority of Pennsylvania's Republicans and none of its Democrats, was signed into law by Governor Tom Corbett on Wednesday evening. One of the stricter laws in the nation, it mandates voters to have photo identification for elections that have to be issued by the federal government or a state government, in-state universities, or a nursing home. There are now 16 states in the nation with such photo voter ID laws in place, and the rush to pass more laws of varying stripes continues. The U.S. Department of Justice just struck down a Texas law requiring strict forms of ID for voting. Attorney General Eric Holder cited the disproportionate disenfranchisement of Latinos as a result of the law. Texas follows from South Carolina, where the DOJ also struck down a voter ID law last December. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 gives the federal government the right to strike down state laws that may result in racial discrimination at the polls. On Monday, a judge in Wisconsin struck down a voter ID bill signed by the notorious Governor Scott Walker on the grounds that it was unconstitutional. Such laws are being enacted based on claims of voter fraud. Wisconsin Judge Richard Nice wrote in his opinion, "Voter fraud is no more poisonous to our democracy than voter suppression." The growing trend to pass voter ID laws since last year in particular has been linked to the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, a right-wing body of state lawmakers and corporate representatives whose model bills were leaked to the Center for Media and Democracy last summer. Writing for The Nation, journalist John Nichols cites that ALEC's Legislative Joint Finance Committee co-chair Robin Voss, quote, took the lead in advancing voter ID laws against significant opposition from civil rights and open government groups. But the backlash has begun in earnest, citing their serious concerns over voter suppression, particularly of minorities. The NAACP, considered the largest and oldest civil rights group in the country, met this week with the United Nations Human Rights Council in the hopes that the international body would take some action. And the largest federation of unions in the nation, the AFL-CIO, has taken on the rash of voter ID bills, vowing in a press conference this week to counter the laws which they say, quote, could disenfranchise millions of voters. Meanwhile, upsetting the voter ID trend is Virginia's General Assembly, which this month enacted a pair of bills that would actually expand the type of eligible voter IDs to utility bills and bank statements. My guests are Diana Kasdan, counsel for the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and Julie Green, deputy political director of the AFL-CIO. Welcome to Uprising, Diana and Julie.
Good morning. Thank you.
Julie, I'd like to start with you. Why is this an important issue to the AFL-CIO?
Well, protecting the rights of everyone to vote has always been an important issue to the AFL-CIO. And as you referenced in your opening, this year, the laws have just changed over the course of 2 years so drastically and so dramatically in so many of our key states. This is something that we feel is an imperative part of our Labor 2012 program. We can't afford to sit back and watch millions of voters be disenfranchised. We can't do everything, but it's important that we use our resources strategically, that we work in coalition with our partners, and that we do what we can to make sure that we're doing everything we can to make sure voters are educated on the laws that have changed, know their rights, that we have poll workers and poll monitors out there on the field. And we do everything we can to make sure people's votes are protected on Election Day.
Well, Diana Kasdan, I think we should sort of spell out what's going on here, because it seems as though these laws are specifically designed to target Democratic voters, and they're being pushed by Republican Party members. So that it's pretty clear what's going on. The Pennsylvania bill that we mentioned made an allowance for nursing home IDs that was fought for as an amendment by groups like the AARP, which, of course, we know that seniors tend to be more conservative and vote Republican. But students who may be from Pennsylvania, but from an out-of-state or at an out-of-state university, wouldn't be able to use their university ID to vote. Is it clear to you, or can we see clearly from this trend what's happening here in terms of a partisan war?
You know, what we can see is the reality is the laws impact all kinds of Americans, but certainly specific groups, be it minorities, students, the disabled, and the elderly, they feel the impact the most. And actually, I point out with the Pennsylvania law, despite that one exception for someone in a nursing home, most citizens, elderly citizens who are not in an elderly, in a nursing home, are going to be impacted negatively by this law. They don't have the kind of ID that is required.
Right. Do nursing homes actually even issue such IDs in general? Or?
For someone who's over 65 and not in a nursing home, we're talking about 18% of the population at that age range doesn't have the type of ID required by this kind of law. So we actually see these laws as having a negative impact on the elderly as well as minorities, such as we were talking about before, the Texas law. Hispanic voters in Texas are about two times more likely not to have the type of ID required by that state's law. So these are having a negative impact on many groups. And overall, what we're witnessing is a cutback in voting rights that exceeds anything we've seen in decades. It's a wave of restricted voting laws. And so, whatever the intentions are, it doesn't matter as much as the reality. And this is creating huge burdens for many populations.
Well, let me refer that same question to Julie Green. What do you think about or how do you see this trend playing out during a presidential election year where the stakes are pretty high?
Well, we absolutely think it's related, and all you really have to do is go back in time 4 years ago and recognize that in 2008, this country had the highest voter turnout that it had had in four decades. Obama won 70% of all new registered voters, and Democrats in 2008 added two-thirds of new voters to their rolls. So I think that this is something that the Republicans and the Tea Party really took notice of, and as a result of the 2010 elections, where we saw numerous, state legislatures and governorships and key states switch from being Democrat to Republican, in addition to the many attacks that we experienced and are fighting actively every day on workers' rights. We saw these various different types of voter suppression bills get filed, whether it was voter ID specifically or cutting back early voting, making it more difficult for citizens to register to vote, making it more difficult for all voters to register to vote in general. We definitely see a pattern, and, it's something that we are actively fighting. And just to go back to Diana's point that she was talking about, specifically with who this affects, in Tennessee in 2010, after they passed their voter ID law, which was modeled after ALEC legislation, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which you had referenced mm-hmm. earlier in your remarks, there's a woman, Dorothy Cooper. She is 96. She was born before the 19th Amendment was ratified, which gave women the right to vote. She grew up during Jim Crow, and she had voted in every single election for the last 70 years. When she went to get her voter ID that was required, she brought her Social Security card, and her she had an ID issued by her local police station and was told by her local DMV that that wasn't enough evidence to get her state required government photo ID. So she went back. She brought her birth certificate, she brought her Social Security card, she brought her lease, and she brought her, her locally issued ID that her local police station had given her, and they said that that wasn't enough. Wow. And they said it wasn't enough because she didn't have her marriage certificate, because Dorothy was born with a different last name than, it is now because she got married. So the problem with these laws, and they poll very well because it sounds very reasonable, but each state has different requirements for getting your government-issued photo ID. So it affects women, it's affecting veterans, it's affecting students, it's affecting the disabled. And when I first heard about Dorothy, I immediately thought, how many 96-year-olds are going to keep going back
right.
and back to protect their right to vote?
And that brings me to an important point, which is how serious is this pretext that there's widespread voter fraud? Diana Kasdan, you're with the Brennan Center for Justice. Listening to a lot of the lawmakers pushing these laws, one might imagine that there are hordes of people who are technically ineligible to vote that are lining up eager to cast their votes and change the political system. Is that happening?
No, and, you know, photo ID laws are attempting to solve a problem that simply doesn't exist. They're written under this guise of protecting against voter fraud, but you're more likely to be struck by lightning than to see someone commit in-person voter fraud. And actually what's interesting is the recent objections from the Department of Justice in Texas, as well as its earlier one in South Carolina. In both of those, they found there's a lack of any evidence that voter fraud's a real problem, and that when it does occur in a few instances, the existing state laws are fully remedying those problems. So this is absolutely trying to solve a problem that does not exist out there.
And on that same issue then, Diana, how is it being justified? And is this the basis that judges as well as the Department of Justice are now going to be striking down these laws, as well as on the basis that it's going to severely impact significant numbers of people from voting?
Well, the Department of Justice has found both that there isn't a justification, that, you know, the premise of these laws is not supported by the evidence the state submitted, but also that the evidence the state submitted showed they will have a discriminatory impact. So what they found in Texas was that, for instance, you know, according to the state's own data, Hispanic registered voter is at least 46.5%, potentially 120% more likely than a white voter to lack the required identification. So clearly a discriminatory impact. So it's both the fact of how this will suppress the vote among minority populations in those states, and the fact that the states cannot even justify any need to do that. And I think that is the same, you know, those are the same reasons we're seeing in the courts. The Wisconsin's decision was based on the state constitution and specifically found that, you know, this law in Wisconsin is suppressing the right of voters to exercise their fundamental right to vote. So I think both of those are key issues.
Julie Green, the NAACP, as I mentioned, is going to and has gone to the United Nations to take this issue up. There was also a march from Selma to Alabama this week to, among other things, raise this issue of voting rights. What do you feel that the backlash that these laws are receiving around the country is enough? Is there enough media coverage and awareness that these voter ID laws are, in fact, voter suppression laws in disguise?
Oh, I totally agree with that. You know, one of the things that I think we are actually just starting to see, and what I think that the Selma March highlighted and made really a national, you know, for the first time really this got national coverage because of that, is the problem with these voter suppression laws that have been filed around the country. I don't really think we're at a point where people have really paid attention to what's happening or realize how it's going to affect them. And our Executive Vice President, Arlene Holt-Baker, has really stepped it up and has led in this area and said that this is something that not only has to be an integral part of what our efforts are in terms of getting union members to vote, but we have to go bigger and we have to go broader than that. We have to make this an issue. We have to get people educated about what their rights are so they aren't disenfranchised or intimidated when they do go to vote. You know, the Tea Party is organizing right now. They, you know, plan on training 1 million poll challengers.
Wow.
For the elections this year. It's important that people understand and know their rights. So we're going to do everything that we can to make this a very public issue, get this out. I so appreciate you having us on today because this is a very important issue. And yes, this is something that the media needs to talk about even more.
And Diana Kasdan, speaking of poll challengers, how much of what we're seeing unfolding now is reminiscent of Jim Crow laws in the U.S.?
Well, as I said, we haven't seen this kind of rollback since that era. I mean, we have always been expanding the right to vote, you know, starting with the right of African-Americans, the right of women, eliminating the poll tax, and then we had our seminal Voting Rights Act in 1965. And this is the first time since then that we've seen it going the total opposite direction. So it is really reminiscent of that era, and it's unacceptable. And, you know, Julie's absolutely right. We have to do everything that we have in our power to push back, whether it's working, you know, in the courts, whether it's making sure people who are going to be subject to these laws in effect have all the information they need and have the ID they need if that's the law in effect in their state. But I think there's good news. I think it's true that it hadn't gotten enough attention, but is getting more attention. The fact that DOJ has stepped up with these objections, the fact that we've seen this ruling, two rulings out of two state courts in Wisconsin, and even some of the states proposing these laws have, you know, kind of wound back a little bit. Some of them, you know, going beyond voter ID, there's other types of restrictions out there, such as trying to limit the ability of voter registration drives to help register voters. And, you know, there's bills pending in Michigan and South Carolina. In South Carolina, 4,000, citizens sent letters to their legislators saying, we don't want this. We don't want what happened in Florida, where there's a lawsuit pending that we're involved with challenging that law. So I think there's a momentum now to push back, and we just need to continue that, as Julie was saying.
And so finally, Julie, give out the website where listeners can find out more about the AFL's plans for countering these voter ID laws.
Sure. Our website, actually, which we have newly relaunched, it's www.aflcio.org. We invite you to please come on our site. There are links that are on the home page. And actually, if you go to our site, you will see one-pagers for every single state that have information on exactly what the laws are. One of the things that we recognize is that the laws are the laws this year, and we're not going to be able to change them. So we feel it's important that people have the information they need to be able to vote. We also have put together a voter suppression and voter ID toolkit that has a lot of good information about these laws, sample letters to the editor, you know, ways that everyday citizens can fight back. And I also have to really give, you know, a lot of appreciation and credit to the Brennan Center and Diana, the work that you guys did really coming out early on the report that you put out on the voting law changes for 2012. I just think that's an excellent piece of work, and I would encourage people to go and look at that as well.
Right. Diana, give out the website then for the Brennan Center for Justice, where people can find this trove of information that your group has put out.
Sure thing. It's brennancenter.org. And if you go right there, you can link to our voting changes in 2012 report that Julie just mentioned. And thank you, Julie, for, you know, those nice comments. And we track all the legislation that passed in 2011 that's passing now. And we're actually going to be updating that to the extent there's still bills out there that may be moving through the rest of this legislative session, as well as all the other information we have in our reports that address some of, you know, these kind of pretextual concerns for justifying these laws.
That's so Brennan,
information.
BrennanCenter.org. Well, Diana Kasdan and Julie Green, I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Diana Kasdan is counsel for the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Again, BrennanCenter.org is the website. Julie Green is deputy political director of the AFL-CIO. Their website is aflcio.org. If you missed any of these websites, just check uprisingradio.org later today for the links. Or you can also sign up to our mailing list and they'll arrive in your inbox. This is Uprising. After this week's Rethink Reviews, Walmart is pushing for its first new store in Los Angeles in a decade, and activists are pushing back.
I'm Jonathan Kim, and this is Rethink Reviews, where we take a deeper look at current and past films and how they relate to the world today.
Do you even know the Miranda rights?
Yes.
Let's hear them then.
It obviously starts with you have the right to remain silent. I know you've heard this before. And then I think it sounds something like... Well, you have the right to remain an attorney.
Did you say that you have the right to be an attorney?
You do have the right to be an attorney if you want to.
When I heard that the late 80s TV show 21 Jump Street was being remade as a comedy starring Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum, my heart sank. The original 21 Jump Street was a gritty, sometimes downright dark show about a police division made up of baby-faced officers who would go undercover as students to solve crimes in high schools. Ostensibly a show for kids, 21 Jump Street explored risky topics like racism, gangs, drugs, alcoholism, rape, homophobia, child abuse, and prostitution in a way that imparted lessons without being preachy, gory, or titillating, unlike modern-day police procedurals. And while it's known as the show that launched Johnny Depp's career, 21 Jump Street had a cast that would be considered extremely diverse even by today's standards, where the four main officers were the racially ambiguous Depp, a black woman, a Vietnamese man, and a white man, who were supervised by a black captain. With the issues facing high schoolers today, a modernized 21 Jump Street that retained the gritty tone of the original series and took an unflinching look inside America's high schools seemed like fertile ground that could be the basis for several films. But instead, the 21 Jump Street movie that opens today has only two officers, both white men, and instead of using its premise as an opportunity to take a sober, possibly disturbing look at the lives of America's teenagers, it's only used for laughs. So when I sat down to watch 21 Jump Street, I wasn't just ready to hate this movie, I was eager to. But instead, something funny happened. I found myself laughing. A lot. The film opens in high school, where Schmidt, played by Jonah Hill, is a socially awkward nerd who's picked on by a good-looking meathead jock named Jenko, played by Channing Tatum. Several years later, Schmidt and Jenko meet again in a police academy, where the two of them become an unlikely duo as Schmidt helps Jenko pass his exams while Jenko helps the pudgy Schmidt get in shape. After becoming officers, their youthful looks and immaturity get them transferred to the Jump Street program, where they're sent into their former high school to find the source of a potentially lethal new drug. So why does 21 Jump Street work so well? Much of the credit has to go to Tatum and Hill, who make a terrific odd couple. Schmidt is bumbling, cowardly, and socially clueless, while Jenko is handsome, physically adept, and intellectually deficient. But their childlike enthusiasm for being police officers and the sweetness and vulnerability of their friendship makes them surprisingly endearing, even as they do wildly irresponsible things like beating up high school students or supplying kids with beer and marijuana for a rager Schmidt throws at his parents' house. The supporting cast outperforms across the board, including Ice Cube as the captain of Jump Street, James Franco's younger brother Dave as the school cool kid, Rob Riggle as the PE teacher, Brie Larson as the down-to-earth girl Schmidt falls for, internet star Dax Flame as a helpful nerd, and Ellie Kemper as a teacher with the hots for Jenko. And along with cameos from the cast of the original TV show, the film acknowledges and laughs at the fact that Tatum looks nothing like a high school student, and the movie is yet another in the long line of revamped 80s properties. But 21 Jump Street is more than that, and as I watched the movie, it occurred to me that totally abandoning all but the kernel of the original concept was a pretty clever move. While the original show often had humor, it never mined an obvious idea that the movie embraces, that the Jump Street cops might actually relish the opportunity to return to high school to be the teenager they always wanted to be. While it's sad to have lost all the things that made the original 21 Jump Street such a fascinating, groundbreaking series, it's good to know that it definitely wasn't for nothing. 21 Jump Street is rated R and opens today. I'm Jonathan Kim, and this is a Rethink Review for Uprising.
Thanks, Jonathan. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Walmart, the world's biggest private employer and one of the world's largest corporations, has set its sights on Los Angeles County, getting ready to roll out a series of so-called neighborhood markets. The first such store, about one-fifth the size of the traditional big-box Walmart stores, is slated for LA's Chinatown area in an apartment building near the corner of Cesar Chavez and Grand Avenues. At 33,000 square feet, the store would sell mostly groceries, but still be nearly two-thirds the size of a football field. Bolstering Walmart's case is their claim that the location in question currently has only one other full-service supermarket in a 30-block radius in the area. But some community activists are outraged at the idea and vow to fight it. The Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, or LANE, who in 2003 successfully led the effort against a Walmart big box store in Inglewood, cite poor working conditions as their main opposition to the Chinatown planned store. A press conference by LANE last Thursday featured Walmart employees Angie Rodriguez and Greg Fletcher sharing their stories of how Walmart's wages are so low they require government assistance to survive. In 2004, Los Angeles passed a citywide ordinance banning big box stores, apparently in response to popular opposition to Walmart superstores. The proposed Chinatown Walmart would be the first of its kind in LA. It circumvents the superstore ordinance because of its relatively smaller size and products being limited to groceries. It would also be the giant corporation's first new store in Los Angeles in nearly 10 years. My guests are Aiha Nguyen, who is the senior policy analyst on the Grocery and Retail Project and LANE, Chris Chung of Wonder Bakery in Chinatown, a 30-year-old family-owned business. Welcome to Uprising, Aiha and Chris.
Thank you.
Well, first, Aiha, let me start with you to tell us a little bit about the background of LANE's work with the Inglewood fight in 2003 that had a lot to do with the ordinance. Give our listeners a little bit of a history lesson about how Walmart has attempted to enter LA County in the last 10 years.
Sure. Well, the Inglewood fight was particularly an egregious move by Walmart because they came in and basically put an initiative on the ballot, bypassed the local government and the planning department, and said, this is exactly what we want at this parcel, and we're going to take it right to the voters, and if the voters vote for it, we get everything we want, and there's nothing that the city can do about it. Well, Lane got involved, and we were able to referendize that initiative so that it didn't get passed, and Walmart didn't have pretty much a pre-pass to do whatever they wanted. They have, however, continued to do this in other locations across the country. And in Los Angeles, because Lane passed the Superstores Ordinance, Walmart hasn't tried to come into Los Angeles, but they have open stores, for example, in Rosemead. And right now, what they're trying to do is open a large superstore size Walmart in Burbank. Their new strategy is to basically select sites that have already received all the entitlements so that they don't need to go before the city's planning departments for public review.
Well, Chris, tell us a little bit about your business in Chinatown and this claim that Walmart would be coming into this area that doesn't have enough stores for people to shop at.
Well, One Bakery, my business has been in Chinatown for over 30 years, and I understand that Walmart will have the bakery divisions over there in Chinatown. So it definitely has some conflict with our products as a bakery. Not just our bakery in Chinatown. There's over between four more major bakeries in the Chinatown and some other small bakery in Chinatown. So if they sell bread and buns, and I'm not sure about they sell cakes. If they sell cakes, yeah, there's a big conflict with us. They're a big company, and they sell it lower quality with the cake. We are high quality birthday cake with fresh fruit. So the low price will definitely will take away the cake sales from the small guys, bakers like us.
So you're saying that the smaller mom-and-pop establishments like your store, Wonder Bakery in China, would have a very difficult time competing with pretty much one of the biggest corporations in the world.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the basis on which Lane is opposing a Walmart in Los Angeles and in particular Chinatown. The salaries that Walmart pays its employees, it employs something like 2 million people, the biggest private employer in the world. Some of these Walmart employees have to take government assistance, even though there might be full-time employees of Walmart?
Yeah, exactly. The reason why Walmart is such a big deal is because they are one of the largest corporations in the world. People don't realize their sales in 2010 were six times that of the Target Corporation. And they have been the leaders in depressing wages of workers in this industry, such that I believe a couple years ago an audit found there were 17 states in which Walmart was the number one private employer with the most number of employees on public health care assistance. And we're afraid that in Los Angeles, where the grocery industry has been able to provide middle-class jobs for many Angelenos so that they can support their families, those wages will be further depressed by the entrance of Walmart.
And as I mentioned, they are circumventing this ordinance by having a smaller version of their traditional store. So instead of having a department store that also sells groceries, it's going to be primarily a grocery store. Is there anything in the ordinance that could be used to oppose this Walmart?
Unfortunately, there is nothing in this ordinance that could do that, but we are working in order to find as many opportunities for a community to have a voice, because essentially that's what happened by coming in as a small store. And by the way, a lot of residents didn't know it was going to be a Walmart because there was no information released. So the community didn't have an opportunity to express any their concerns about it. What we're trying to do is, first of all, this project was built in the 1990s, but it received a significant amount of city subsidies through the Community Redevelopment Agency.
And you're talking about the building that Walmart is trying to occupy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes. And two of those requirements, or one was that the project needed to provide 190 approximately permanent jobs, and we feel that Walmart should supply the majority of that, seeing as they are the largest anchor tenant. And secondly, there were requirements around appraising of that land if that land value were to go up, there should be some requirements for the developer to pay back the cost of the subsidy that was given to them through the land. That's one thing. Secondly, we believe that the council member from the district and the city at large should really look at whether this is what the CRA had in mind. Was this the spirit of what the CRA wanted when they granted a subsidy to build this project and bring in a grocery store? Now, there's been a lot of Walmart has been saying there's no grocery stores. There are indeed actually three grocery stores in Chinatown and then another one just outside of that area that serve the population, and they would be in direct competition with Walmart.
Well, Chris Chung, one of the criticisms that, one of the arguments in support of this type of store is that working people like to have a one-stop grocery store instead of having to, you know, go to your bakery to buy their bread, go to another small store to buy their produce. It's convenient to have it all in one place in Walmart. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think. That is probably preferred by a small number of people. And I think our bakery have a little bit different than some special features about the bakeries in Chinatown. And that will also provide a better opportunity for the consumer to come in to. And I don't think that is a good argument. I think the most important thing, you have to look at the big picture. The big picture is that Walmart will hurt the local business. That there's so much investment and many years of investment. And
Chris, do you think that it would also change the culture of Chinatown?
I think somewhat, especially maybe the younger people, because I don't really have a detailed assessment of that, but I think it definitely affects a lot of grocery stores. A lot of grocery stores.
There's
over 10 small grocery stores besides 3 to 4 big ones.
Ai-Han Wen?
Sure, I'd like to contribute to that. I do think it would change the character of Chinatown. For one, it's a very walkable community, so it's very convenient. But if the small stores that are there are put out of business, the convenience that is provided by Chinatown changes right away, and you actually have less access if there is now all you have is that Walmart there. And we do know that Walmart has a reputation because they are so big, because they're able to advertise on radio, TV, television, and because they squeeze their suppliers, they can get cheaper prices, that they do often put small mom-and-pop businesses out of business. And the second thing I'd like to mention is, while there is no, one example that you could possibly look at is Little Tokyo, not too far away, which in about 5 years ago didn't really have any chain stores, and now there's a Pinkberry, a Yogurtland, a Starbucks, a Quiznos, a Subway, and an Office Depot. And the character of that neighborhood is starting to change very rapidly.
And also, isn't it true, Aiha, that in communities across the nation, when we see Walmarts coming in, first we see the small businesses disappear because they just can't keep up with the competition. But then often when Walmart decides that location is not profitable, they may shut down, leaving behind blight in its wake.
Yeah, exactly. They do have a reputation of land banking, which is, a term that's often used to describe that. They buy a lot of property or they lease a lot of property, and then they don't release it so that new development can happen once they leave. And I'd also like to point out that the Chinatown store is the first, but Walmart doesn't do anything small. They're a large corporation, and they will do things big. We suspect that if they want to achieve the same level of density of market share in grocery sales that they do nationally, it's going to be about 20% of the LA market, which could amount to about 200 stores in Los Angeles.
Wow. And so this is sort of a test case, you think?
We think so, yeah. They're seeing whether this model of entering into smaller spaces and existing spaces will work. And they did the same thing in Burbank, where they took over a location that was already built and constructed, and that's a test as well.
And I want to ask you the question that I posed to Chris, which is, how would this change the culture at Chinatown? I suppose your comment on Little Tokyo is answer enough.
Well, like Chris's business, which has been around for decades, many of the stores there have also been around 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and they are primarily small mom-and-shop stores. Sometimes they've been in the same family for generations. They already operate on very small margins, and that if they're put out of business and, you know, chain stores like Walmart come in, it's going to look entirely different. We're afraid that Chinatown will lose its historic character. It will look historic, but the heart of it, which are the people and the businesses there, won't remain.
And then, Aiha, what sort of opposition is this particular Chinatown Walmart plan facing? Certainly, small businesses like Chris may be feeling threatened and may join in the opposition. But is there widespread opposition in the community, or is the community sort of being caught off guard?
Partly the community is being caught off guard, but we work in coalition. We have been talking to residents and youth who live in the area and their parents, and even teachers, who say that they really are concerned for the future of Chinatown and for the future of, you know, Los Angeles at large. And of course, workers who know about the quality of Walmart's jobs are concerned about what that's going to bring to Los Angeles.
Well, give our listeners a little bit more information, Aiha, of where they can go to if they particularly live in and around the Chinatown neighborhood. Where can they find more information?
Sure. They can go to Lane's website. It's laane.org, and click on the Grocery and Retail Project, or Healthy Grocery Stores Project. It has both names. And contact us, and we will definitely get in touch with them, and we would love to get them involved in this effort.
And Chris, where is your bakery located? If listeners are in and around the Chinatown area, they can certainly find you.
Oh, yeah. We are located at 943 North Broadway, Chinatown, right on the entrance of the old Chinatown.
Well, we'll post that information, including your address, on our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. Chris, best of luck to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Chung is with Wonder Bakery in China. It's a family-owned business that has been in the area for 30 years. Aiha Nguyen is senior policy analyst on the Grocery and Retail Project at Los Angeles Alliance for New Economy. Their website is lane.org, laane.org. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Wendell Berry once said, "A proper community is a commonwealth, a place, a resource, an economy. It answers the needs, practical as well as social and spiritual, of its members. Among them, the need to need one another." That's Wendell Berry. That's Sonali's Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Tamika Miller is our engineer. Visit us online at uprisingradio.org, where you can listen to all of our interviews, rate them, leave comments, share them on Facebook, and find links and events we mention on the air. Send us your story ideas at mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kohatkar. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you Monday at 8. Ooh, oh.